Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much for that news update, Greg. There'll be more news with Mr. Host at 7 o'clock. Right now, on this day in history, we start in 1833. A gentleman by the name of Alfred Bernard Nobel, a Swedish inventor who invented dynamite, was born on this day. Yes, the same Alfred Nobel that the Nobel Prizes are named after. In 1984, on this day, Niki Lauda would take his third driver's title, beating Alain Prost. In 1986, on this day, IBM, the computer company, would reform in South Africa. Now, Reform having been a company that supposedly shut down its operations in South Africa. And that's quite an interesting story there. It seems as though there was a time where international companies, as part of the sanctions that we went through, would announce that they've sold off their subsidiaries to South African employees. In this case, that was the IBM case. And then subsequently would then enter into exclusive agreements with the new company to continue to supply them. So it doesn't really seem like a corporate exit, but gets around sanctions, I suppose. 1990, on this day, Ayrton Senna would win his second title despite crashing out of the Japanese Grand Prix. In 2001, on this day, United We Stand, the concert put together by Michael Jackson, would take place on this day. That would be a concert remembering the events of 9/11, of course. In 2007, on this day, Kimi Raikkonen would beat Lewis Hamilton by 1 point to win his first title. And in 2019, on this day, the Prime Minister of Canada would lose his majority. That would be Justin Trudeau, obviously, would lose the electoral majority, but would win most seats in a government, forming a minority government. Look at that. GNU was around before we thought of it, I suppose. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and on the show today, we're taking a look at the e-commerce industry. We're speaking to the Competition Commission around the measures that they would like to see put in place to make the e-commerce space more competitive and level the playing fields there. We've got a conversation with Outa as well around the fuel levies. We know that fuel levies have been on the rise. In fact, they've increased almost 100% since 2015, and we're going to be taking a look at that with the organization under doing tax abuse, trying to understand the levies and what we can do about them going forward. Then we've got a conversation with Adams and Adams around trademark laws. There's been some developments in the counterfeit space, and one of those developments has infringed on a trademark, or potentially infringed on trademark laws. We're going to speak to the experts around that and understand that and try and make sense of it. Then we've got a conversation with 91 around staying patient during times of volatility and as part of your long-term investment strategy. And we wrap the show up with a personal finance segment on the financial complexities associated with getting divorced.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Let's update those markets. We're joined on the line by the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Makwe Maselela, to take a look at the market movements throughout the day and what we could potentially be in for the week. Good evening, Dr. Maselela. Lovely to speak to you as always. Markets started off under a lot of pressure, surprisingly, but pressure on all sides. What seems to be going on?
Evening to you and to the listeners. I think markets are taking a breather, and I think that's one of those days where we re-emphasize that markets don't go up on a straight line. And Jimmy, though investors are more upbeat about the global economy after some rate cuts, earnings reports will be important, especially given that valuations are stretched. And we've seen the People's Bank of China cutting their benchmark loan price rate by slightly more than expected today. And these cuts, remember, that are coming amid that flurry of measures from Beijing to try to revive the economic growth. And we know that we've got finance leaders, central bankers meeting for that annual IMF and World Bank meeting, or the debate thereof, because countries are expected to discuss how to navigate this low growth and high debt. So, yeah. And meanwhile, Russia is also hosting a summit of BRICS leaders from Tuesday as Kremlin seeks to get some support. You know, we know there's this standoff with the West, and leaders from Brazil, India, China, South Africa, this time they also include Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Remember, these guys, they account for almost a third of global economic output. And we know that the Middle East tension continues to escalate as well. And more importantly, I think markets will want to see those earnings coming through, because ordinarily that's what should be driving the markets, whether companies are making money or are not making money.
Marco, you mentioned those earnings. We kicked off earnings season last week with the banks. They were quite impressive in some of the numbers that they gave us. What are we expecting this week? Are there any major companies reporting earnings that could potentially drive a lot of the sentiment?
Yeah, you know, I mean, overseas, you're talking the likes of Tesla. I mean, that's one of the first magnificent seven companies to report. The likes of Coca-Cola, also a nice bellwether when it comes to the economy, and also the likes of General Electric. And then I think as well in Europe, you're looking at the likes of SEP as well, where the companies are, they continue to spend money, you know, using their software or not. So those kind of earnings, people will be watching to see exactly what is it happening in the real economy, and more importantly, that what is the outlook going forward, given that people start to expect interest rates to go down. So what are the expectations? Or maybe are we only too excited as market participants vis-a-vis what is expected by the bosses of all those major companies? Continues to be very important to get their insight as well.
You mentioned outlooks, Makwe, and I saw that if we had a look at just the movements, the only real sector at the moment that is looking positive is the commodity space, with commodities prices continuing to somewhat recover from the lows that we've seen. And commodities counters, resource counters today, the only sector that remained positive. How important is it now to take that step back? You mentioned this at the start of our chat, Makwe, to say that markets don't move up in a straight line, and sometimes you'll get those corrections, but it's important to look at things holistically, that these markets have been moving in a certain way throughout the year.
You know, I prefer to separate gold from other commodities, because gold gets to be moved by different things, you know, seen as a hedge against political uncertainty, economic uncertainties, you know, what is happening around that. And those things tend to work negatively when it comes to other commodities. My point here is, as much as we've been complaining that the details or the stimulus that we've been getting from China has not been that sufficient, but I think markets are saying at some point that, listen, something is happening that side. Guys want to make sure that they meet their yearly economic growth target, and this is the last quarter for them to be able to do that. And if all these measures that the Chinese have been implementing come to fruition, then definitely there should be some nice uptick when it comes to demand. And as we see demand picking up from that side, again, given that China continues to be the major consumer of most of those commodities, then you'll expect to see those commodity prices to continue to firm up. So my point here is, what sometimes works for gold tends to be negative for other guys, because if there's no economic growth, unfortunately, then those other commodities don't be a need to be to have some demand coming from that side. But that might benefit the likes of gold, which we know that gold is almost up almost 34% so far this year. So I think other commodities, they still have a long way to catch up to make sure that they get to at least the decent levels. And bearing in mind the possibility of what is happening with the dollar, because most of them are priced in dollars, if we continue to see the dollar not doing that great, that will also make it affordable for holders of other currencies to be able to buy those commodities. So yes, I agree with you. I think commodities, they stand a good chance, because as we said earlier in the intro, that investors continue to be upbeat about the global economy. And I think as well, we have to hear what the guys say from the IMF and the World Bank tomorrow when they release their outlook for the economic growth. If it's more positive, then that will also say that commodities might continue to be in demand. But we don't expect all this to shoot out the lights, but at least you should be expecting some decent growth.
Speaking of things that people have to say, I was surprised to see a love letter in the SENS announcements today. It's not often we see one of these, and we got a very nice letter from the CEO of Naspers, updating us on his first 100 days in the role. Anything stand out for you in that letter?
Yeah, definitely. Remember, this is not just any other ordinary CEO. This is the guy, you know, who acquired iFood in 2023 when it had only 20 people working for it and managed to grow it. So this is the guy who at least understands the delivery, the food delivery business, and they expect to continue to invest in their businesses to align it, to make sure that AI stands out there, so that they also get to a point where the likes of take a lot, they sharpen their focus, you know, make sure that they move faster and deliver superior services. We know competition is already back home here, and they also expect to see their investment in India to do okay, and expect one of the companies that said that they own to be able to do an IPO. And remember as well, they did manage, what is that company, the Trip whatever, that they managed to sell as well. So the guys are trying to streamline the and structure the eMAC and committed to business for the full year profitability come 2024. And that's in addition that iFood managed to hit almost 100 million orders per month for the first time. And the companies we're talking, Jimmy, I mean, it's got Proxas is valued at almost 100 billion, and they expect to double that.
Well, we'll have to see how that shapes up, because that is certainly a high expectation from any company to double that business. But we'll have to leave it at that, Makwe. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Makwe Maselela, Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, on some of the market movements throughout the day and what sentiment could potentially be looking like.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Ready to take control of your financial future? Moneyversity Plus is your go-to streaming edutainment platform for all ages. With fun, engaging content and downloads for kids ages 6 to 17 and practical lessons for adults of all ages, Moneyversity Plus makes learning about money easy and exciting for everyone in the family. Plus, as you learn, you can earn Old Mutual Rewards points, a win for your wallet and a win for your future. Whether it's mastering money basics or planning your financial goals, Moneyversity has you covered. Start streaming today and join thousands of others at moneyversity.co.za. Your plus one for financial wisdom.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We know that the e-commerce space has been quite the buzz around what's been going on there with competition, to the extent that at some point last year, I think it was July of last year, the Competition Commission had to publish an online intermediation platforms market inquiry around how they saw the space and what potential changes might have been needed in the space. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Economist at the Competition Commission, James Hodge, to take a look at what's been unfolding in this space and how we process it and make sense of it. Good evening, James. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly an interesting time to be looking at markets like the e-commerce space, especially with the developments in technologies and the number of new entrants in the space. Is the space becoming more competitive, or are things just getting more complicated?
Well, I think they are getting more competitive, but I think we also need to distinguish the different types of players. So Amazon has entered the market and has a presence in South Africa. It has distribution centers and is rolling out, I think, nationally its delivery service. But that is different to the kind of Shein and Temu who are really importing into South Africa and have their operations offshore and then rely on some of the courier services domestically to deliver. And having a presence nationally, we see from experience, means that you can get the bulk of the e-commerce trade. And so certainly Takealot now faces a rival that is obviously a global company with enormous capabilities that it brings to the South African market, but starting off with a small share of that market, but certainly the capabilities to bring important competition. I think with Shein and Temu, the issue has more been around trade policy and tariffs, because they're not present here. As you're aware, the concern has been about whether they're bypassing tariffs on clothing and other products, and therefore coming in a sense very cheap, and and below the cost of which people importing clothes would otherwise come in at. So I think it is an interesting time, and it is a time when I think government needs to look at all its toolkits, not just the competition toolkits, but also trade and industrial policy, to shape the digital economy in a way that serves the country best.
James, one of those tools is the South African Revenue Services. They came out very clearly with a VAT on imports of goods in excess of 500 rand directly in response to the concerns you raised around those circumventions of tariffs by international players in the space. And I wonder, from a Competition Commission point of view, how do you then look at something like that as a measure and balance it out with, yes, the Competition Commission's role is to ensure fair and equitable markets and balanced competition, but at the same time, you don't want to be closing off markets or closing off external guys from the local market per se and creating an environment that isn't really conducive. How do you balance that from a competition perspective, but also from an economics point of view?
Well, I think one has to start from an economic policy perspective, because trade policy is there to regulate foreign competition against domestic production. And really a trade policy is trying to find that balance that, you know, bring that competition from globally to keep prices down and to keep domestic players under pressure, but not so much as to destroy the domestic economy. The Competition Commission is looking at the markets within South Africa. We do factor in the international aspect of competition, but as an overall economic policy, you could say within the Ministry or Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, one has to look at these different tools and how do you ensure good outcomes for consumers, but at the same time development of the local economy. And I think the debate in digital that is starting to now take place, and it's happening through the Sheen and Temu, both domestically and globally, this debate is raised, is to what extent do we want that happening, that investment in our own country, rather than just being a consumer of foreign digital services that don't create employment, investment or jobs in South Africa. And so certainly from our perspective, we have a development mandate as well as a competition mandate. So these factors do have to come into our thinking, but as part of the agencies within government, we also need to locate ourselves in that broader debate about what we need as a country.
There's a lot that we need to discuss from that perspective. James, before I let you go, I want to look at some of the sentiments from the Competition Commission's side around using all of those tools, but also around the sweeping changes that need to be enforced in line with the market inquiry that was put forward. We want a sustainable and a cohesive online marketplace or an e-commerce environment within South Africa, and something that the likes of Takealot have put forward is that there should be things like employment requirements put forward for foreign operators. Is this something that you think would be more beneficial towards the overall space, or would that do more harm? Obviously, understanding that we have an unemployment rate that does not look anywhere near sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. Our inquiry focused a lot more, at least in the e-commerce space, on the treatment of marketplace sellers on these platforms, because you know, people use Takealot and now Amazon to sell products through them and use their distribution, and that's a benefit, but it also can be a bit one-sided relationship. So I think those guidelines and remedies were important in ensuring that the business that use these platforms are protected. What we're faced now is with that bigger question around competition, certainly between the platforms. Look, I think Takealot is rightly raising the debate. Do we need a kind of, and it may be more of an investment industrial policy that looks to promote domestic? One can do that simply through tariff and doesn't need other rules, because if tariffs reach a level, then players will make that investment. So I think it's the right questions to be asking. Whether that's the answer, of course, is something I think we do need to consider, and whether there are unintended consequences, or whether it does promote employment. But certainly I think what's been made clear by the President and the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition is we have to have a plan to create jobs and industrialize through the digital markets as well, not just the traditional markets. So we have to be thinking about how we get those investments into the country and how they're used to grow employment and deliver benefits to the economy.
And alongside that plan, we need to have implementation strategies, because that's also a key part of that. But we'll have to come back to that conversation at another time. Thanks so much, James, for the insights. James Hodge, Chief Economist at the Competition Commission, on their views on the e-commerce space and potential regulatory measures that might be coming up.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Speaking of regulatory measures, the fuel levy, such a painful thing to think about, and such a painful thing when you think about exactly how much of your petrol price is going into that levy. We're going to be taking a look at this following the sentiments suggested by our Minister of Department of Mineral Resources around how to potentially tackle this, and the fact that the diesel price or petrol price could be as low as 14 Rand in South Africa. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of the organization Undoing Tax Abuse, Wayne Duvenacher, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Wayne. Lovely to speak to you again. This is a very interesting perspective from the Department of Minerals and Petroleum Resources, that our petrol price should be at a much lower point than where it is now.
Yeah, look, I mean, don't get me wrong, we'd all love that, but that is just populist rhetoric from the minister, quite frankly. And he knows very well that for decades, many years, and this is the same in many countries around the world, fuel is taxed. It's a one form of revenue. And the fuel levy has been applied. It has gone up year on year, well above inflation for far too long, which is while we were tracking this and starting to put pressure on government to stop those incessant increases. And fortunately, this latest new minister, not so new anymore, Enoch Godegwana, for the last 2 years has said, he's heeded that call. And he said no more increases to these two big tax levies, which is the Road Accident Fund and the General Fuel Levy. If we didn't do that, by the way, we'd be paying another Rand to Rand 50 per litre right now as we speak. So he has put the brakes on that. But these are real taxes. They're not just artificial taxes. And if you want to take them away, well, that's great. We must, if we can. But he's got to replace that. Treasury is going to have to find, from the fuel levy alone, about 90 billion Rand from somewhere. Unless they can reduce costs, reduce corruption, maladministration, well, that would be great. That would be the first place to start to boost the economy. So good idea, but how they're going to do it is the big question.
Implementation has never been our strong suit. We keep trying, but I mean, it seems as though we can't get that right. Wayne, I want to look at the expense or the relative cost of that. I mean, there's statistics that say that we rank among the top 10 countries in the world of the most expensive fuel price relative to monthly income. Now, that suggests that there's a multitude of problems there around the costs and the fact that people aren't earning enough to sustain those costs. But when we look at our neighboring countries, we supply fuel into other countries on the African continent. Should we not be passing that levy on to those parties as a method of recovering that, and not necessarily putting the burden on South Africans?
Well, not necessarily, because those countries, this is a tax that is applied here and the money is used by our government. So what happens is they will transport fuel from our harbors directly to, let's say, Botswana across our network. So there's a higher transport charge. But their government is saying, well, we're not going to apply a road accident fund and a fuel levy. Maybe there's a small amount in that. And there are another 10 levies mixed up in another 5 Rand 17 cents in amongst that as well. So, and that before you even pay for one drop of the petrol that we buy, we are paying 10 Rand, close to 11 Rand now a litre, before you pay for the petrol. And then the petrol is subjected to, you know, the international pricing and the Rand-dollar exchange rate. So in Botswana, for instance, well, they'll be buying it in the international exchange rate. If the pool is a bit stronger, they get it even cheaper than us. And they'll just be paying the transport costs and whatever levy. So, yes, they do have their petrol cheaper there, but we can't subject them to a tax which we will use here. All they'll do then is get their fuel through Namibia, through Mozambique, you know, the other avenues. So we've got to be very careful not to cut off our nose to spite our face there.
That makes sense, Wayne. So then how do we address the inefficiencies? Because the inefficiencies are clearly what's leading to the fact that we're able to collect 90 billion plus rand in levies, but those levies are not properly dispensed or properly redistributed to benefit South Africans. I mean, the understanding, of course, around something like the fuel levy is that it's a general tax aimed at improving roads and ensuring that we have the infrastructure that comes from that. But in some cases, we don't even have that. So how do we address the inefficiency?
That's a good point. So let's start with the two. The Road Accident Fund is one of those highly inefficient, wasted taxes. In fact, in 2014, that tax was, or 2015, was just over a rand. And the next year, they shot up by 50%. And there was government again, just throwing money at the problem, and the Road Accident Fund saying, oh, we can't manage our processes, so we need more money. Instead of telling the Road Accident Fund, which I should be doing right now with Collins, Letsoala, and everybody there is really, the maladministration is gross, is to deal with the issue of the efficiencies of the Road Accident Fund. So that tax is, a lot of it's wasted. And then, as you say, the original intention when these taxes were first introduced, and that's right in the apartheid days, was to say, well, let's introduce a fuel levy because that's closer to a user pays principle. If you drive in cars that use petrol, we're going to have to upgrade the roads, so therefore you will pay directly. And that concept, by the way, is used around the world. There's nothing foreign about that. And obviously, our government's kept on doing it, but it's not ring-fence for roads. So it's a nice source of revenue. And when you start getting broke as a government in the past, they've done, oh, let's just increase the fuel levy by 20 cents, 30 cents. People don't notice it. But over time, all those taxes have added up, and they've come from about 4 rand 50 back in 2010, 4 and 55 rand to now closer to 11 rand. So it's added up. And now if you got the petrol price for free, I think you saw when COVID was on, the general fuel price dropped right down, and we couldn't get our fuel price down to below 14 rand because and we were buying it far cheaper than we've ever done before because of all these taxes.
Perhaps we should explore the idea of ring-fencing things to improve accountability. That's an interesting theory. We'll leave it at that, Wayne. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Certainly something to reflect on and something to think about as we look at this unsustainable fuel price and how to potentially address that.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, several weeks ago, there were some developments around the counterfeiting space. There have been various things that have been unfolding in this space, and one of those things has been the fact that we're seeing an increase in the number of counterfeit goods that are making their way into SA markets, and that's a serious concern because it creates a lot of worry around how people are getting these goods into the country, what's being done about them, and more importantly, how to address it. One of these concerns has spilled over into a large retail company as well that has recently been on the receiving end of some very negative movements around the goods that they've been imported. It's forced them to take these goods off the shelf. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the legal sides of addressing counterfeits, dealing with trademarks, and understanding what a legitimate product should look like and what protections are there for consumers, more importantly. I'm joined on the line by the partner and trademark attorney at Adams & Adams, Yannick Renier, to take a look at this and try and understand what we can make of this. Good evening, Yannick. Thanks so much for taking the time time. Let's start by understanding the trademark laws in South Africa and how those laws are designed to protect consumers against counterfeit products.
Thank you, Jimmy. Yes, I think that is very important. I mean, every brand owner, as consumers would refer to them, should be aware of the steps that they should take to protect their valuable assets, and we certainly have the legislation in place. So as a starting place, we would definitely advise these brand owners to file and register their trademarks. Once those marks are registered, they have the relief that is provided for in the Trademarks Act, which includes obtaining interdicts, preventing these third parties from taking advantage of their brands.
Now, there's two things to look at here. From a brand perspective, as the brand owner, you register the trademark, and understanding, of course, that there's trademark registrations around the world and you need to register trademarks in South Africa to be protected by South African law. I want to look at that in a second, but I want to start by looking at the role of the distributors, the suppliers, and those that consumers purchase from. Because more often than not, I mean, if you're purchasing from an online store or you're purchasing from an intermediary, a distributor, there it gets a bit gray there. But if I'm purchasing from what I would think would be a reliable retail environment, there should be some level of responsibility that those retailers have taken to ensure that they've got the right products.
That is so, and they are quite at risk if they do not do that. I mean, the act of counterfeiting, if you are dealing with counterfeit goods, you can be held liable and be found guilty of an offense. So there is certainly a responsibility on retailers to do their homework, to check that the products are genuine, and just get their ducks in a row.
How do we know whether or not the products are properly registered and licensed and regulated? Because as a potential retailer, I could come out and say, I had no knowledge that this was a counterfeit good at the time that I imported it from outside the country. And since then, I've taken it off my shelf, for example. How do we know that proper due care has been followed?
So in South Africa, there is a register of trademarks. It's quite easily accessible. So retailers could certainly start there and do a check of the brand and see who is the registered proprietor. That would certainly be a starting point.
And in the case of a retailer that has a lot of brands, I can imagine this becomes difficult when you are stocking multiple brands from around the world and you kind of have to keep a consolidated register of all of this. Is there a workaround for that, whether from a retailer perspective or from a consumer perspective, to just say, hey, heads up, this is a consolidation of the current authorized trademarks in South Africa, and should we be giving more visibility towards that kind of list?
I can imagine that that would be quite difficult to maintain with fast-moving consumer goods. I'm not sure how you would manage that practically and how consumers would be able to access that as well. So I can imagine that that would be quite difficult.
What do we then do from a registration process? So let's look at the other side of it from a product perspective or from a product manufacturer point of view. I've got a product. I want the product to be trademarked. There's a process I need to go through. I could reach out to an IP company or legal firm such as Adams & Adams to help this process along. But what are some of the easy things I need to be aware of when registering a trademark?
So definitely we would advise third parties considering to register a trademark to do a search, you know, do a check. You want your mark to be respected, so do that check. Make sure that the mark that you want to use is available for registration in South Africa, and then you would file it with the registrar, who would examine the mark, and it would go through the process. It would be accepted and advertised, and third parties could oppose that mark should they wish to, and then it will proceed to registration. And it is a step that is essential at the beginning of the process, because even if you're considering, let's say if you're considering going into South Africa, you have 5 years from the date of issuance of the registration certificate to start trading. So, you know, you don't need to have immediate plans, but you must certainly have an intention to start to trade and to use that trademark in the territory. So it's being proactive on the part of entrepreneurs and brand owners that want to come into a territory to really do the due diligence.
Yani, how do we use this kind of legal tool in our arsenal to fight counterfeit goods. I'm thinking about the recent developments we've seen in the media with young children dying from the wrong kinds of products and all sorts of things there. And obviously that presents a different kind of health concern. But the manufacturers of those products would have trademarks in place from their perspective. Is there something we can then use within trademark law to say that if you as a service provider, as a intermediary or as a company selling these things, if you are found to be selling counterfeit goods, these are the consequences?
So that's obviously an important consideration, and that's effectively what needs to happen is consumers need to be protected. So immediately one of the thoughts that I had is that it is possible to register or record your trademark with customs. So that would be, I suppose, the first stop and check to make sure that those unauthorized goods don't enter into South Africa if they are manufactured abroad. And then in terms of our Counterfeit Goods Act, you can in fact lay a complaint and obtain a warrant for search and seizure to remove those goods that you suspect are counterfeit from the shelf. So that is definitely steps that you could take.
See, now that's an interesting perspective, pairing trademark law with customs law to protect the South African environment and the South African consumers. Certainly something worth looking into and something perhaps we should send to our friends at the Department of Trade and Industry and International Cooperation. We'll leave it at that. Yanni, thanks so much for the time and the insights. Yanni Krunier, a partner and a trademark attorney at Adams & Adams, on how trademark laws could potentially be used to fight and address the counterfeit problem.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. We've often heard that in savings and in investing in particular, patience is the most important virtue to have when it comes to building a long-term wealth, building a sustainable portfolio. And we're going to be taking a look at that and trying to understand the value of that characteristic and of that kind of discipline when it comes to investing. I'm joined on the line by the sales manager at 91, Paul Hutchinson, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Paul. Lovely to speak to you again. Savings is one thing, but having the patience to build an investment and having the patience to see long-term growth is something that every investor probably needs in their arsenal. I mean, a recent study suggests that the behaviors of investors are important when we look at how you approach your investments. What do we know about just some of the key indicators around having patience when it comes to your investments?
Yeah, thank you, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. Being impatient really does result in investors often losing out on returns that they would have had if they had just stayed invested. And there are any number of studies that give evidence to this. I think the longest study that I've come across is one that's been prepared by a financial services research firm in the US called Dalbar. And they recently released the results of their 30th annual investor behavior study for the year to the end of 2023. And really what this study is looking to do, it's looking to measure the difference between what an investor actually experiences and what the portfolio itself delivers. And the reason that there is a difference between what the investor experiences and what the portfolio delivers is because investors are making buying and selling decisions often when they shouldn't. And if you just look at the most recent calendar year, the US equity market was up 26% in 2023. And what they were able to determine is that the average equity investor realized less than 21%. So they gave up roughly 5.5% by making injudicious investment decisions during the course of that year. Importantly, it's enduring. So over the longer time periods, this average investor gap, so the difference between portfolio returns and investor experiences, remains significant. It does lower, but it's roughly around 3.5% per annum over both 5 and 10 years. And if you think about compounding that difference over the long term and what that would mean for investors and their retirement capital, it really is the difference between retiring comfortably and potentially having to work significantly longer than what they would ideally like to.
I suppose, Paul, this puts into perspective why some funds have sort of minimum lock-in periods and those sorts of things around when you can access those funds or when you can divest from a particular product or a particular strategy, because they have this sort of concept in mind to say things will get volatile and it's just about seeing your way through that volatility. When we look at that volatility, there's this concept called a funnel of uncertainty. What is that? Explain that to us and just take us through that.
Yeah, so it's really looking at market volatility. And I think we all understand that market volatility is more pronounced over the shorter term. And the range of return outcomes narrows substantially as the investment time horizon lengthens. So we recently ran a study where we looked at global equity markets and we looked at one-year returns. And then we compared those to three-year annualized returns, five-year annualized returns, 10-year annualized returns, et cetera. And if you look at the range of return outcomes over rolling 1 years, the worst rolling 1 year return was -48% at the depth of the global financial crisis in 2009. And yet the best rolling 1 year return was 58%. So the range of return outcomes at its broadest was over 100%. Now, if you compare the lowest and the highest rolling 10-year annualized returns, the range narrows materially from a low of 3% per annum to a high of 13% per annum, so a range of return outcomes of 10%. So you can see over a 10-year period, the range of return outcomes narrows from as high as 100% down to 10%. And that really goes to the point that with time comes a greater degree of certainty. And what's also interesting to observe is that over rolling 10 years, there hasn't been a negative rolling 10-year return. So again, to that point, that as you extend your investment time horizon, so there's a higher probability of generating positive returns from your investments.
Paul, you brought up the financial crisis of 08, arguably a very painful time in everybody's life. And it got me wondering around the negative years, those really big impact events like the financial crisis, like the COVID-19 period. A lot of people would have said, I would have been better off just cashing out of my investments and waiting out of the storm and then coming back after that. Is that the right approach? Because there's other studies that suggest that weathering the storm is a safer approach.
So I'll give you a personal experience. I was invested, or I am invested in a global equity fund that during the COVID crisis, so in 2000, was down 70%. So if I had $100 at the depth of my personal experience, I was at $30. If I had exited that investment and switched to cash, I would have earned an interest rate in a dollar cash investment of, let's call it 3 or 4%. So it would have taken me multiple decades to get back to my $100. Fortunately, I made the decision to remain invested because nothing had changed in the company that I was invested with. The portfolio manager was unchanged. The philosophy and process was unchanged. And within 18 months, I had recovered back to my $100. And that's what's also interesting about that rolling one-year study that we referenced in the funnel of uncertainty. The worst rolling one-year return was -48% for the 1 year to 28 February 2009. The highest return was +58% for the 1 year to 28 February 2010. So only a year later, if you'd sold out in that worst period, you would have missed the opportunity for much of the recovery in the following 1 year period. And that often happens where following significant underperformance, there is some recovery, which is significantly above that which you would have got in a cash investment.
So clearly, it's unavoidable that we're going to experience market volatility and market instability. I think the point here is, of course, as we mentioned at the start of the conversation, around understanding how to be patient through these times. Paul, before I let you go, let's look at the role of a financial advisor in this kind of context, because more often than not, the lack of patience comes from a personal perspective. But if you're speaking to a financial advisor who understands your portfolio needs, who understands your overall goals and objectives, and who may have been through multiple financial events such as you have and has that experience, how much more value does that then add to the conversation to say, just keep calm and stay patient?
100%. There is significant value to be had by working with a financial advisor who can counsel you through this period. But very importantly, at the time that you would have made the investment, you would have better understood the type of investment that you were making and the period for which you needed to measure the performance of that investment. So being invested in equities, you would have been counseled to understand that it's a long-term investment, to look at it over rolling longer periods, rolling five-year periods, as opposed to rolling one-year periods, and therefore would be better prepared for the volatility that's sure to happen in the shorter term.
Patience is everything. Don't underestimate the value of just keeping calm when you're investing in your long-term strategies. We'll leave it at that, Paul. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Paul Hutchinson, sales manager at 91, on the value of patience in your investments. This feature was brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change.
The more time you give yourself to save for retirement, the bigger the reward at the end. Don't waste your head start. Start investing now and choose the future you deserve. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's a Monday, it's time for personal finance, and with all these conversations we try to get as productive and as helpful as possible with these segments. This week we're taking a look at a very painful side of finance, and that's what to do from a financial perspective when going through a divorce. Nobody likes to have those conversations, but the reality is they are a real, and with the growing rate of divorces in South Africa, these are probably going to be coming up more and more often. Joined on the line by financial advisor at Momentum Financial Planning, Leonie O'Connell, to take a look at this and see if we can best prepare ourselves. Good evening, Leonie. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding some of the financial risks that come with an event like a divorce.
Jimmy, I think obviously there's huge financial implications for both parties involved in case of divorce. Most instances, we'll have to set up separate households. There's a direct impact on our retirement savings. You have maintenance, children possibly changing schools, and duplicate financial expenses in a case of a divorce.
Some of those sound very obvious and very familiar, but one of the other ones that we often don't think about is that the actual divorce process itself is a costly exercise in itself. Everything from legal fees to understanding how things are going to be divided and all of that, that cost in itself is something a financial planner should be able to plan for, or it's something that you have to consider when looking at the planning process.
100% agree with you, Jimmy. That is a huge expense that is incurred at point of divorce. But I think that's what makes it so essential to have proper legal advice and financial advice when entering into a marital regime, when you actually get married. You know, that from the point go, that you have those boundaries in place, that the contract's in place, and that everybody knows where they stand in case of a divorce, that you don't have to fight those arguments at that point, elevating costs unnecessarily when you do actually get divorced.
I was going to come to that, Leonie, to say that a lot of conversation has been had around having a antenuptial agreement, or a prenup as it's more commonly referred to, and there's a lot of misconceptions around that. My partner doesn't trust me, this doesn't make sense, why are we having this in place? Let's look at that in a bit more detail around how preventative measures can help in the event of, or in the unfortunate event of, a divorce, because nobody wants to go through a divorce. Nobody gets married anticipating a divorce, but preventative measures could make it easier.
100%, Jimmy. I know this sounds cliche, and I always say to my clients and anybody I engage with, and unfortunately, it is a fact that the person that you get married to is not the person that you're going to get divorced from. So it is very important that both parties are protected going into the marriage. So it's not about trust, or not about planning and setting up to fail. It's just to ensure that everybody's best interest is taken care of in the event of something happening and we actually have to get to a divorce table. something that people also don't consider post-divorce that I would like to raise also, Jimmy, is people don't think about the fact that they have to change their wills. So in case of a divorce happening, people often neglect their will. There's so many things happening in the legal process. You know, as you said, the divorce, the child orders, the maintenance orders, that we don't think of actually changing our wills. And a will will be enforced if you don't change your will 3 months after your divorce. The court will accept that you don't want to change that. So if something happens to you, your will be enforced. So if you haven't changed your will and everything goes to your ex-spouse now, the court will enforce it as it stands. So that's something that people also need to consider in divorce proceedings.
You bring up the will, Leonie, but I want to go back to the conversation or the point that you made earlier around the retirement impact. I remember when we started implementing a two-pot, or we were discussing two-pot prior to the September 1 implementation, there was a lot of concern from a financial advisor point of view that there was a conflict in divorce law and this new amendment to the retirement laws that were being put in place. Has that conflict been cleared up now? And what do we need to know around the retirement considerations where it relates to divorces?
Jimmy, I think when it comes to divorce and retirement planning, obviously, depending on the marital regime, your spouse have potential to actually access your retirement savings when you do get divorced. And again, in this instance, I think it's crucial to have a discussion with a financial advisor so that they know exactly what that impact is on your retirement savings and that you can manage that going forward. You know, sometimes it's better to actually realize assets and give your spouse rather a cash portion than actually access your retirement savings. So if you are due X as a part of your divorce settlement, rather sell that expensive car or sell some property to free up some cash and actually make the payout instead of actually delving into your preserver or into your pension or your provident fund.
That's very useful, because sometimes you think that division of assets or addressing those issues is something you can always do at a later date, or you're forced to do it. And I think we often don't realize that if you sit down with a financial advisor, you sit down with someone that has been through this process as a professional, you can actually navigate the conversations slightly differently and lead to a more peaceful resolution or more peaceful outcome. Leonie, when it comes to those other expenses, you mentioned something that stuck with me around the doubling up of expenses, because now suddenly we used to be one household incurring one electricity bill. Now it's two households and two electricity bills, and you have to kind of navigate that aspect of it. How does that affect the budget?
That has a significant impact on the budget. So we'll often just think of split costs, split rental, split bonds, like you now mentioned, split groceries, split water and electricity. But there's also significant things that come into play, like medical aid, for example. If you have two main members on a medical aid, you know, if your partner decides to have their own medical aid or yourself, that's an extra cost that you're incurring. Also, potentially something we don't look at is short-term insurance. If your partner had always paid the short-term insurance, you are now taking over short-term insurance, your own short-term insurance with no claim history. So your premium might be significantly higher also. And again, there, I think navigating just as a married couple, but operating as individuals so that you maintain your identity, your own credit record, your own short-term history, claim history, so your own retirement savings, so that when you do, if a divorce does happen, you know that you are and can function as a solid like individual without having to incur extra expenses as a result of that.
Nobody likes the idea, but you'd rather be prepared for it than not. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Leonie. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Leonie O'Connell, who's a financial advisor at Momentum Financial Planning, joining me to take a look at the financial implications of going through a divorce.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's been the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, we're going to put them up online, as we always do, so you'll be able to catch up on those conversations. It is getting close to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hose is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. It also means from my side, good night.